ground shortly here, and H minus 10 seconds, the countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. Greetings, everyone. It is Saturday, the 24th of December, in the glorious future year of 2022. Interestingly enough, this is not the last show for the year. No, indeed. We had a show on the first day of the year, and we will have a show on the last day of the year. And that is entirely the result of the fact that 365 is one more than an even multiple of 7. But it means that this year we'll have more of these Saturday shows than any other year could have. So I'm not going to do a year-in-review show today. I don't know if I'm going to do a year-in-review show at all, to be perfectly honest. Who knows what'll happen? It's below freezing here, and has been below freezing for a couple of days, which is not exactly the sort of thing that I enjoy. But we have electricity and gas here, so I'm better than I could be. Still, I've got, you know, muscles in my neck cramping up and sinus pain and all that kind of thing. And I wish that I just had the cooling water from a nuclear power plant, you know, accumulating in a big pond so that I could float on it and be warm. Anyhow, so today is the 24th of December, and tomorrow we will, of course, commemorate the birthday of someone, a man who was born centuries ago, and whose thoughts and ideas are fundamental to our modern society, really shape the world we live in today. I speak, of course, of Sir Isaac Newton, Lucasian professor of mathematics in the University of Cambridge, and sometime master of the Royal Mint. But, yes, the 24th, the 25th of December, for many people, I suppose, the great message that they hear this time of year, that they would like to hear this time of year, that they would like to give to others this time of year, is peace on earth, goodwill toward men. Peace on earth, goodwill toward men. And, you know, I can't help remembering the poet. And in despair I hung my head, there is no peace on earth, I said. For hate is strong and mocks the song of peace on earth, goodwill to men. That was written at the height of the American Civil War. Peace on earth, goodwill toward men. Something that most of us desire greatly. Most of us would give a great deal to achieve. But it seems as though those in whose power it lies are not nearly that interested. There are, it seems to me, two aspects to this problem. One is to try and see what we can do to reduce the tensions between and within the nations of the world, to reduce the inequalities, right, which lead one group of people, whether that be domestically or internationally, to feel that they have less to lose by rising up against another group than they have to gain, which is usually a dangerous illusion. And, on the other hand, how it can be that we avoid or eliminate this social model in which violence is not merely the last resort, but a frequent resort for people who don't really have anything else they could be doing. So, I think about it this way. You know, it's very difficult because we have somehow succeeded, and a very dolorous kind of success it is, in creating social mechanisms in business and government which reward the kind of behavior associated with sociopaths. People, in other words, who treat other humans as means to an end. People who use others. People who don't care about others. People who have no fellow feeling or sense of brotherhood. Almost everyone agrees that this is bad, and yet we have these structures which reward that behavior. So not only do genuine sociopaths rise to powerful positions, but we also take ordinary people who are not sociopaths and we educate them into sociopathic behavior. We encourage people to behave in what most people would agree are immoral and destructive ways. This is, withal, very strange. And I don't know that I have a solution for it, but the first step on the road to recovery is admitting that you have a problem. So that's one aspect of it, to be sure, that for some reason we have a society which rewards those people who are working most actively to pull down society. That is a very great problem. And it will require, I think, an interior revolution, if you like. I can't offer too much in the way of suggestions or solutions when it comes to that. But we can talk about the nature of those social structures, how they evolved, why they're like that. And I would argue that a great deal of the problem, whether it's with capitalism or with authoritarian government or what have you, a great deal of the problem is that these are structures centered around scarcity. That the political and economic systems we live with are evolutions from a period in which, as I've said many times, only a small elite could really enjoy the good things in life because there simply wasn't enough to go around, because the millions had to toil if the hundreds were to be able to have their books and their universities, and so on. And so, the possession of leisure, and the possession of education, and the possession of culture became intimately tied up with the control over other human beings. And to an extent, As long as that situation of true scarcity existed, I won't say it was a good thing, but it was, as it were, morally neutral. It wasn't terribly destructive, but now we have the ability to get out from under that. Now, one farmer can produce enough food for 100 or 200 or 500 people. Now we have machines, as I've said over and over again, machines to do the heavy work. They've even built machines to lay bricks. If you think of that, you know, there was a beautiful form of vaulting that was introduced in the late 19th, early 20th century. It was extensively used in New York for a while. There was a particular, I believe, Italian architect who was extremely fond of it. And it was brick vaulting, which was extraordinarily economical of materials because it was all tessellated and interlaced. But it was very expensive in terms of labor, and so it fell out of favor in favor of things like poured concrete. But if we have machines to build those vaults, then we can save both labor and materials. Right? You see where I'm going with this, I hope, that it's not a simple set of choices that we face anymore. The roads diverge in many directions now, and it's difficult to choose the right one, but going down along the one we've always been on is clearly the wrong one. That as the ability to do things in the world, to make changes in the world, has expanded, so too has the scope for people to do bad things. Right. The 20th century, in many ways, is remembered as a century of genocides. Not that such things didn't happen in the past, but that for the first time, it was possible to use things like railways and machine guns to do it on a vast scale. The 20th century is remembered as a century of colossal wars for the same reason. And honestly, there's not much difference between war and genocide. We live in an age now of mass media. And it's interesting because people thought that the internet might break up mass media. But thanks in large part to Negroponte at the MIT Media Lab and his ideal of convergence. Well, thanks to many things, but I like to blame him. He annoys me. He always has. He was the one basically who sank HDTV in the US. Thanks to this ideal of media convergence, you know, you get the same ad on your computer that you get on your TV. Your computer may be your TV. Your TV may be your computer. We've turned, you know, taken that late 1990s, early 2000s web TV thing and turned it inside out with these so-called smart TVs. So you're now watching YouTube videos on your TV. Isn't that wonderful? Well, perhaps I've wandered a bit far from the point, but we look at the tensions between nations in our world today, and many of them have to do with prosperity, right? You have the question of migration, people wanting to go from one country to another, other people not wanting them to go from one country to another. And some of those people who are trying to leave the countries they're in are trying to escape violence, whether that be open war or banditry or drug trafficking gangs making life unlivable or whatever. They're trying to get to a country where they perceive those things as less problems, or at the very least, to get away from the situation they are in, and the easiest way is to cross a national boundary, right? Because we continue to insist that national boundaries are important, even now, more than 50 years after the three men of Apollo 8 looked back at the Earth and saw it as a single entity. Such a powerful image. Right. What did they say? They said, "A Merry Christmas and God bless all of you on the good earth." Incidentally, I've been working on using the badge machine to make some new badges using some of my space postage stamps, and one of them is an Apollo 8 Christmas badge. The post for this show, the post on anonradio.net, my weekly post that I always put out for this show, includes an image of that selection of badges that I'm working on. They're not very artistic yet, but I think, you know, it's a first draft. It's getting there. But no, crossing national boundaries, and many, many people reject crossing national boundaries. They say this is a bad thing. Nobody ought to be allowed to do that. We want control over who comes in, who goes out. It seems to me these people are saying we want higher walls on our prison. But you see it, right? You see the Greeks and the Italians and the Hungarians and the Poles all saying, "Oh, no, 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 these people from wherever they're coming from must not come in. We don't care if they drown in the Mediterranean. We don't care if they freeze to death in the mountains. They must not come in. We don't want those people. Having those people here will ruin our way of life." Well, I doubt that that's true. But I'm not even interested in engaging with the question, because I'm more interested in the question of how do you make it possible for them to stay where they are, right? And sometimes, not by any means always, but sometimes, part of the answer is better energy supplies, which we can do with nuclear energy. Right. Better energy supplies, which will allow industries to be built up in poorer countries, small nuclear power stations, which can be installed in rural areas, which eases the pressure of people in those rural areas moving to the cities, because now they can harvest their crops or what have you, whatever their local industry is, and develop and make them into value-added products, which they then sell in the city, which improves their prosperity, which means that fewer people are forced into the cities, right? Because they can't live in the countryside. It also, if people are taking the raw products and making them into value-added products, then the lack of adequate transportation infrastructure is less of a concern because, flour is easier to ship than grain, that kind of thing. So that can be a small part, at least, of the solution. But ultimately, to a great extent, it requires people to identify what the problems are locally that are causing these internal tensions that are then leading to the necessity that people perceive for migration. And it requires them to want to alleviate those internal tensions, which is a second problem all by itself. Because, of course, there are many people who aren't interested in alleviating those tensions. Whatever's causing those tensions, they see as being good for them. These problems are complex. And then, of course, we have, as everybody knows, right, one of the big things that's driving international tension today is this question of climate change. Now, nobody really knows what the effects are likely to be, but one thing is certain, and that is, whatever the effects are, it will be far easier for the wealthy countries to adjust to them, to cope with them, to rebuild when things are damaged. And this naturally enough, leads to a certain amount of resentment from the poorer countries, who are going to be the ones most affected. Doubly so because they say it's the wealthy countries who have burned all this fossil fuel, which has added this carbon dioxide to the environment, that is apparently the cause of these problems we're experiencing. Why is it that we have to suffer while they benefit? Right? That, and they also say, why is it that they say we shouldn't use fossil fuels in order to improve our situation? Right? That the people in the poorer countries don't want bad things to happen to them. Well, that's not such a strange thing, right? And they see that the wealthy countries, with their still largely fossil fuel-based energy systems, are the ones with the resilience to cope with these changes. And they say, well, why shouldn't we be allowed to do the same thing? Right? Why shouldn't we do the same thing? And there are various attempts to cope with and mitigate this. You know, there's proposals that the wealthy countries should set up funds where they will reimburse the poor countries for loss and damage, which doesn't actually build up the resiliency of the poor countries at all, does it? I would say that the solution to this one, at least, really obviously is nuclear energy. For the wealthy countries to cut out burning fossil fuels and shift over to nuclear energy, because it is the source of energy that is feasible to shift over to, right? All these so-called transitions to renewable energy, they haven't really resulted in anything of the kind. They haven't really resulted in decreased use of fossil fuels. And at the same time, providing energy for the less wealthy countries so that they can make themselves resilient. And again, I've called in the past for the equivalent of a nuclear Marshall Plan. But the thing I want to bring up in this context of peace on earth, goodwill toward men, is that the nuclear weapons states under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, they have abrogated their responsibility. You know, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty is supposed to be this grand bargain whereby the signatories who do not have nuclear weapons will accept intrusions on their sovereignty, intrusions on their sovereignty of an entirely unprecedented nature and scope, that they promise not to make nuclear weapons, not to attempt to acquire nuclear weapons, not to help anyone else build nuclear weapons, and they promise to submit to a system of inspection, internationally organized inspections, to make sure that they don't do that. In return for which, the nuclear weapons states, right, which also happen to be the big five, the permanent members of the United Nations Security Council, pledged to provide assistance in the uses of nuclear energy for peaceful purposes. And within a few years after that treaty was ratified and entered into force, the nuclear weapons states had completely and absolutely abrogated that pledge. They set up organizations like the London Suppliers Group, the whole purpose of which was to stop nuclear energy technologies from being used by poorer countries. Why? Well, the only realistic, right, I mean, it was always couched in terms of weapons proliferation, but we're talking about countries that were signatories of the NPT, right? The truth is, the only real motive which I have ever been able to adduce for this behavior was the fear that the poorer countries would become less poor. They would stop being suppliers of labor and raw materials and become competitors, which really shows a complete lack of understanding of the global community. It really shows a complete lack of the viewpoint from Apollo 8. That is what we must have, friends. We must have that viewpoint that sees the Earth as a whole, that sees the Earth as a little blue and white marble that you can cover with your thumb stretched out at the end of your arm. Friends, so long as the weapon states remain in flagrant violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty in this way, how can we expect countries to engage in negotiations towards disarmament, towards pacific settlement of disputes, towards de-escalation, towards greater levels of international cooperation, internationalization, open borders? How can we expect any of these things when the most powerful countries in the world, the countries with the arsenals of weapons poised to annihilate our entire civilization, the countries with the massive armies, the countries with the massive economies, those countries solemnly pledged to give every kind of assistance without stinting to the other countries of the world in return for those other countries' pledge not to build nuclear weapons. And then the nuclear weapons states completely, utterly abrogated that agreement. How can we expect anybody to enter into good faith negotiations and processes for building a peaceful world? Not just a world of ceasefires, not just a world of frozen conflicts and cold wars, but a world of peace, a world in which everyone can have confidence when he goes to bed at night that he will not be bombed before morning, and it doesn't matter if it's a conventional bomb or a nuclear one, when it lands on your house. How can we expect peace to grow in the world if the countries that have the most to say about it remain completely uninterested in fulfilling the most solemn obligations they took upon themselves, specifically for the promotion of peace and the prevention of war? You know, I've read to you before the preamble to the Charter of the United Nations, right? Which talks about the incredible destruction of war and how the Big Five, who just coincidentally happened to be, right, the nuclear weapons states, the United States, the Soviet Union, China, France, and Britain. The Big Five and all the other countries associated in it with them, to prevent so that future nations need not be scourged under the lash of war. Friends, I don't know what the solution is, but I believe, and I've thought for some time, that the non-weapon states of the Non-Proliferation Treaty have got to start insisting on the enforcement of its promises, and they've got to start working. Countries like Argentina and Brazil have got to start working together to freeze out the weapon states and build an alternative for themselves. Anyway, you've been listening to A Step Farther Out on Anon Radio, which is a service of the SDF Public Access Unix System. Send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. I'll probably read them.